From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the head of Michigan's Department of Transportation answers your questions about our roads, potholes, orange barrels, and more.
We're not investing enough back into this core asset that we use every single day that, frankly, the generation before us gave us. And we need to figure out, how are we going to do that? What are we going to leave for our kids?
Living with early onset Alzheimer's that strikes before someone turns 65.
It takes people away, but they're still there. And that's hard to watch. It's really hard to watch your loved one fade away.
And the Hello Girls, thousands of American women who served in World War I as telephone operators.
At the height of their time in the war, they were connecting 150,000 phone calls a day.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
As Michiganders drove to work or school today, a lot of us were dodging potholes and we were rumbling along on cracking or crumbling pavement. This is certainly the time of year when the condition of Michigan roads is especially top of mind, and people are wondering, what'll it take to get our roads and highways in better shape? And that's why this edition of Am I Curious is focused on your questions about our roads. And with us now is the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation, Kirk Steidel. It's a pleasure to welcome you back to Stateside.
Well, it's great to be here again. Thanks.
We have been asking Michigan radio listeners, what do you want to know about our roads? And they certainly chimed in with no shortage of questions. So we want to thank you so much for being here to answer them.
Sure.
So we're going to hear now from our first listener.
Hi, my name is Sarah Bliss from Ypsilanti, Michigan, and I wanted to know, where does all the money from our license plate registrations and renewals go? Those fees are so expensive, and we should have better roads.
Kirk, what do people need to understand about those fees and how they fit into your road repair budget?
That's a great question. Vehicle registration fees, so all of the license plate tabs that you and I all pay, that plus the state gas tax that's paid at the pump, not the sales tax, but the gas tax. All of that is restricted by the Constitution. It has to go to transportation purposes, so it can't get pulled off to anything else. Now, once it comes to transportation, it then goes through a formula that divides it to a variety of places, but at the bottom of it, it's 620 agencies that have jurisdiction over roads in the state. So that's cities, villages, counties, and MDOT. So you take all of that money, and the registration fee actually makes up about half of all of the revenue that goes into the fund to pay for Michigan roads. So it then goes into all those different agencies, and then they make those priorities about what they're fixing in their particular community or county, and it moves from there.
Let's go over to Michigan radio listener Georgianne Salvia. She sent us a question. She says, I would like to know why we cannot get roads repaired that last longer than 1 year. Do they not know how to repair roads? I'm sure you hear that a lot. Why does it seem something's getting patched and, by golly, less than a year later, they're back out redoing it?
Sure. You know, every time we drive down the road, you or I or anybody, and we see an orange barrel, we think, okay, well, they're fixing this road forever, right? And it's a 20-year or 30-year repair, and they're not going to be back to do anything. Well, what we lose sight of the fact is, let's say we drive down, you know, Interstate 96, or Interstate 75, just pick your favorite one. As you drive through that construction zone, it's maybe a minute or two that you're in that construction zone, or maybe 5 or 10, and then you're gone. And then the next year you come back, well, it seems like the barrel's in the same spot. Actually, they've moved down the road. Now, those repairs, sometimes we reconstruct everything. But sometimes that pavement has a lot of life left in it, so all it needs is some concrete patches. Or in many cases, it just needs an asphalt overlay. Or in some cases, we're just sealing the cracks to keep the water out, or maybe the surface has gotten so bad that it actually, instead of patching all the potholes, it was easier just to take the top inch off and put another inch on, knowing it's not going to solve the problem, but it's cheaper than sending the maintenance crew out there all the time, you know, every other week filling a pothole, and in the end you end up with a smoother road that costs a little bit less money. It has a much shorter life. But you only paid for that short life, too. You have to look at the whole life of this asset. It's not, you know, when you take your vehicle in and you need an oil change, you don't say, well, why are there, why don't you just replace the engine? That'll be better.
Over to our next listener.
I'm Charlotte Finnegan from Jackson, Michigan. And my question is there a difference between asphalt and concrete mixtures where some of those mixtures last longer on the roads than others? An example is McDivitt in Vandercook, which is a little local town here. That road was just redone in the last couple of years, and now it is as if meteorites had hit it all the way down the road.
So I would ask, what did they do? Did they just put that thin asphalt overlay on top that gave a smooth riding surface for a couple of years, again, probably spending, you know, the equivalent of, say, $1, or did they totally rip everything out all the way down to the base and rebuild it all back up again and spend the equivalent of $20? You know, I don't know specifically that particular route, but I would say that if something came apart within the first year, it was probably a shorter-term repair to start with. If you look at some of the major freeways that have been redone in concrete or asphalt, when we've really dug everything out and full depth replaced everything, those, first of all, have a design life of about 20 years, and those perform really, really well. You know, we're spending the money that we have as far as we can. If you spend it all to just reconstruct everything, then that means other roads will completely fall apart and they'll turn to gravel.
I am interested, are there changes that the engineers are making in the materials and the mixtures that are being used to repair roads to make it last longer? Do we learn more as we go along and how to do it better?
Oh, absolutely there is. And it doesn't matter if it's concrete or asphalt. They're both evolving. We in Michigan are involved with lots of national groups and national associations from the engineering perspective and the specification perspective. So the asphalt mixes that we're using are similar asphalts that are in Ohio and Minnesota or Wisconsin, wherever. They're kind of Midwest. And the same thing with concrete. Actually, there's a national concrete consortium so that the concrete mixers are putting down, they're continuing to tweak those and make them better. And I can say 100% that the concretes that we're putting down now versus 20 years ago are significantly different. The bases are different. The mixes are different. The percentages of all the different components in there are slightly different as well.
Here's a question from listener Jenna Carley. She says, how long will it continue to take to fix the roads that are causing car accidents with all the potholes? It certainly is pothole season.
It's all a matter of funding, right? You can do more long-term repairs, more long-term fixes, when you have the funding to do that. And when you don't, then you've got to do a shorter-term repair. So it would be great to just rebuild everything. First of all, nobody would move while we were doing that. But at the same time, then you would have all the roads to be exactly the same age, and you would have this same problem again, you know, 20 years from now. So it's, what we do is work on it through its life. So it's new, it's young, and then, you know, it's midlife, and then it's finally needs to be replaced. If there's additional funding in there that can do more of those long-term reconstructions, then that will help push it a lot faster.
It's interesting when you think of countries that have excellent roads, chances are they're paying an awful lot in gas taxes, aren't they?
That's very true. I hear that often. People say, well, you know, Germany has better roads or Canada has better roads. What people fail to remember is the taxes that they put on those roads are significantly higher than what they are in the United States. And even within the United States, the amount of revenue that comes from varying sources in different states is different.
Kirk, a number of people are asking, why is it that neighboring states and the province of Ontario seem to be able to maintain their roads better than we do in Michigan? Why is it that Michigan seems unable to do as well as these other places, which, as many point out, have similar climates?
They have similar climates. The geology, in some cases, is different. Even within Michigan, it's different. West Michigan has lots of sands and gravels, and the water drains away. East Michigan has lots of clays, and the water sits and saturates the base down below it. In the springtime, that breakup over the saturated clays tends to make the pavement move a little more. So we see a little more deterioration over the clay side versus the other side. The biggest component, though, is the investment. The investment that those particular states or province make into paying for roads. The case in point of Ohio is Ohio invests $1 billion a year more into roads and bridges in Ohio than Michigan does. And it's not something they just started doing. They've been doing this for 10-plus years. So they've invested $10 billion more in Ohio roads than we have in Michigan. That in of itself makes a significant difference.
That lets them do the major surgery versus the Band-Aids.
Correct. So there's one other piece that that people forget about, and that's toll roads.
Yes.
So people don't want toll roads. The Ohio Turnpike generates money and pays for itself, right? Mm. So I've got to take money, this gas tax registration money, and spend it to take care of I-94, where I-94 doesn't have its own revenue stream.
If there were toll roads, we would be talking a different story.
Right.
You know, people, as we can tell, roads are on their mind, potholes are certainly popping up everywhere. But what don't people understand about what it takes to fix our roads and maintain our roads?
You know, I think every one of us is guilty, and you know, myself as well, that even from a snowstorm, right? So we know what effort it takes to shovel out our driveway or plow our driveway. And we lose context of that when it now becomes 10,000 miles. So while somebody says, look, this is going to cost $1 million to plow the snow for this snow event, $1 million is a lot of money. And in context to our driveway, well, there's no way it should cost that much. But we have no rational basis to make that statement. All we know is it either takes us, you know, half an hour or an hour to shovel out our driveway, or we pay somebody $30 to do it. So it shouldn't cost that much. It's hard for people to wrap your head around the size and complexity of this transportation network that we have, particularly the road and bridge network. I mean, there's 122,000 miles of roads in the state of Michigan, and they go from two tracks, you know, out in the very rural areas to 10 lanes on 696.
Kirk, what do you think needs to be done that is not being done to ensure the long-term stability of Michigan's roads?
Well, first, we need to adequately fund them. What we're seeing right now with this breakup is roads that are at the end of their useful life, end of their design life. And 696 in Metro Detroit is a perfect example. It was designed and built 42 years ago. It was designed for a 20-year life. So while you can fix a pothole, the age of that concrete and its continual pounding by traffic every day and the weather, it's just at a point where it is no longer serviceable. So I think we have to recognize that we made major investments in our road network the generation before us, and we are using it, but we're not replacing it. We're not investing enough back into this core asset that we use every single day that, frankly, the generation before us gave us. And we need to figure out, how are we going to do that? What are we going to leave for our kids?
Well, we'll leave it there. MDOT Director Kirk Steidle, we want to thank you so much for answering our Am I Curious questions.
Absolutely. Thanks.
And if you've got a question about Michigan, send it along by going to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk Michigan history.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
A century ago, as the U.S. was deep into fighting World War I, General Black Jack Pershing issued an urgent call to America's women to volunteer for a new unit with the U.S. Army Signal Corps. And more than 200 women from across the nation responded, and that includes some from Michigan. They became known as the Hello Girls. Here now to tell us more about this special World War I unit is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Great to have you here, Rachel.
Thank you.
So what was the task assigned to the Hello Girls?
So their job was to connect soldiers on the front line to supply line soldiers during World War I. When the United States got involved, they realized that communication lines in France had been destroyed. And so their first task was to relay telephone lines and then connect those two groups of men. What Pershing realized was men in the military were not really good at running those switchboards. It was a really difficult task. And traditionally, switchboard operators were women for a couple reasons. First, they were more polite on the phone, and they were actually cheaper to hire. And so that sort of became a woman's job. And so when it became time to communicate with those two groups of men on the front lines, women were asked to come in. They also needed to be bilingual. American soldiers were having a very difficult time understanding true French accents. And so they needed Americans speaking French because they understood it better.
That was a very specific skill set.
It was.
So just give us a sense of the state of telephone technology that these women were working with. They were not on the front lines?
Some of them were near the front lines, yes. So they would have a switchboard for people who don't know or remember how switchboards worked. You would get on the line and an operator would come on and say, hello. Hence the term Hello Girls, and they would then connect you to whatever line you needed. And so at that time, it was very important to get communication from the front lines to their supply lines and their communication lines to get orders. And so these women would have to hook up all those different lines to get these conversations going. And at the height of their time in the war, they were connecting 150,000 phone calls a day.
A day.
A day.
A day. And there was fierce fighting happening. This was, were they in France and Belgium or just mainly in France?
Mostly in France, from what I've seen, toward the front lines. So, but there's always that overlap.
Were the Hello Girls an auxiliary unit or were they considered military?
Well, they thought they were considered military. They took the Army oath. They had uniforms. They took all the training. They had medical tests done. So they considered themselves military. They could even be court-martialed. At one point in time, one of the women was threatened to be court-martialed because she had spoken with another operator, and it was determined she said too much. And so she was threatened with a court-martial. So based on everything that they were told and the things they had to do to be in this unit, they were, in their minds, military.
But
when the war ended, some of the women stayed actually in Europe to help with some of the peacetime talks. And when they came home, like the men that came home, they sort of went back to their normal lives. A lot of them had worked for Bell Telephone prior to the war, so they go back to their jobs. And when they applied for their pensions and their discharge papers, they were told they could not be in the military because Army regulations say only men are in the military. Therefore, they couldn't be. Despite being told and assured, even by high-ranking officials in the Army, that they were military. So they'd never received their discharge papers at the end of the war the same as men. This also includes later on in the 20s when you get the bonus army and these bonus rewards. They didn't qualify for those either.
Remind us about the bonus army.
The bonus army was sort of money promised to military personnel from World War I. It was supposed to be paid out, I think it was 30 or 40 years after the war. But as the Depression came in and as people were having a hard time finding jobs, they applied for those bonuses early. And sometimes they got them and sometimes they didn't. But these women wouldn't have even qualified.
So really it was a case of, gee, thanks for helping with life-saving communications. Yes. Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Yes.
Boy. So when they got home, I mean, the Army didn't recognize them. Did the public recognize what they did?
They did. The public really did recognize them. And this is true of nurses that came back. The hometowns really did embrace women for their roles in the military units and in the war effort. They were very specialized units, and it was very dangerous for these women to go over there, and some of them didn't make it back.
I was just going to ask, were there casualties?
There was. There was one woman from Michigan who, she died of typhoid, but she died in France, and they buried her with military honors in France. And then when the war ended and things settled down, she was brought back to Michigan and buried in Hillsdale County with military honors. So there were casualties, but the hometowns did recognize them for their efforts.
Now, was this wrong on behalf of the way that the Army and the federal government treated these women? Was that wrong ever righted?
It was. It took about 60 years of constant appeals to the legislature and to the government. So in 1978, the Hello Girls and this unit was finally acknowledged as a military unit, and they were given their discharge papers and any awards that they would have earned. But by then, only a few were left.
I was gonna say, they would have been in their upper 80s into their 90s by then.
Yeah, there weren't many left to actually receive those accolades.
And you did discover, as you kind of dug into this, that there were Michigan women who served. You mentioned the one who died of typhoid. Who were some of the other women?
So we have a woman from, the woman from Hillsdale County that died of typhoid. Her name was Cora Bartlett. And as I said, she died in 1919. There was a woman named Louise Gordon. She was also from Hillsdale County, and she moved to Detroit after the war and worked in the telephone company. And then there was a woman who, and I apologize to her family if I say her name incorrectly, Oleda Jour, and she was from Marine City, Michigan. And she, when she the war was over, came back to Marine City and lived there, and she was one of the women that did get her discharge papers in the 70s.
I bet that meant something, even if it was 60 years later, to actually be vindicated holding a discharge paper.
Absolutely. I think it had to have been. It was a long fight. She did what was asked of her. She did her part. And it did take a very long time to get those papers. But from everything I've read about her, and her daughter still speaks of her, she was very proud to receive those.
Well, it's certainly a part of our military history that I think most people have no idea until today. Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark, thank you for sharing the story of these American women who put their lives on the line and knocked down some stereotypes serving as hello girls during World War I. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there.
A look ahead to tomorrow stateside as President Trump doubles down on his determination to slap tariffs on foreign aluminum and steel. Alarm bells are going off for businesses that rely on aluminum cans and steel kegs, the craft beer industry.
We'll just be eating costs. We can't not buy the aluminum. We have to have the cans. We happen to be a company that's growing very rapidly, so we won't slow down on making products that are in cans, and we won't be passing that price on. So we'll just be investing more into the can. And that investment into that can will be an investment we don't make into something else.
How the Trump tariffs are already hurting Michigan's craft beer industry. That's tomorrow on Stateside. We turn now to our series, Minding Michigan, focusing on mental health and wellness. Traditional wedding vows talk about for better or for worse, in sickness and in health. And when your wife has Alzheimer's disease and you are her caregiver, you learn what those words truly mean. Even more so when she's one of the more than 200,000 Americans with early onset Alzheimer's. That's when dementia symptoms happen before age 65. Jim Manji and his wife Kathleen have been married for 44 years. For the past 9 years, Jim was Kathleen's primary caregiver as her Alzheimer's dementia progressed. Today, she lives in a memory care unit, and he hopes sharing their story will help other caregivers. Jim Manji, welcome to Stateside.
It is a pleasure to be here.
And we also want to welcome Jim and Kathleen's daughter, Charlene Manji. We want to thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Jim, tell us about Kathleen before Alzheimer's. What was she like?
She has always, and even to this day, has been a cheerful person with a smile that just lights up the room. That's one of the many reasons that I fell in love with her a long time ago. But in addition to that, she is a scientist. She spent a good deal of her career as a scientist for the Federal Department of Energy, where she did things like helping to clean up nuclear waste. She got awards from the Secretary of Energy for work like that and for programs for compensating the workers in the Manhattan Project who were poisoned by some of the work they did during that. She felt very strongly about reaching out to these workers who were now dispersed all over the country, tracking them down and getting them the compensation that they deserved belatedly.
When and how did things begin to change?
About 9-10 years ago, both Charlene and I noticed that her memory just didn't seem as sharp as it used to be, and she didn't organize things as well as she used to. She used to be a highly organized person, and it was no one thing. It was a gradual process. So we couldn't say that on a particular day it began.
And how old was she when you first started noticing these things, Charlene? How old was Mom?
56.
Mid-50s.
And at the time, I was living in California. Mm-hmm. I lived there for many years before moving here to Michigan. So most of my contact with my parents was over the phone. And so the way I kind of noticed this was I would have a phone call with my mom and talk about, you know, whatever was going on. And then the next week, I would talk to her, and she would have almost no recollection of what we had talked about just the week prior. Sometimes it was little things, and sometimes it was things that seemed actually were pretty important. And at first, it almost kind of hurt my feelings. I felt like she wasn't remembering important things. But then I started to realize a pattern that she, you know, she was paying attention, but she was not remembering.
It wasn't sticking.
A lot of our conversations, mm-hmm. which was really strange that no one would have ever described her as a particularly forgetful person up until this point.
And I know that you're a school psychologist, mm-hmm. so you have training. Did you get a sense? Who got the sense first that this is something beyond overtired? Oh, you're pointing at your daughter. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, at the time when things were really starting to get worse, I was in grad school for psychology, and my husband's also a psychologist. So between the two of us,
alarm bells.
Yeah, when we would interact with my mom, became more and more clear this was not normal. That things were getting worse. She was not remembering things that she certainly would have remembered a couple years ago. And even in conversation, just sometimes just wasn't really making sense.
So did you broach this with your dad?
I did.
Tough conversation.
Yes.
What'd you
absolutely.
Say?
Gosh, I can remember it pretty clearly. It was over the phone. I was in California. I think I started to cry during the phone call and say, "Dad, I'm really worried. Something seems wrong with Mom. She's not remembering things. She keeps forgetting conversations that we have." And I know he agreed that he had seen some similar things. And I think both kind of hopefully and also just kind of seeing things differently day to day as opposed to coming in and out with conversations, his first thought was an Alzheimer's. It was, you know, maybe there's some mental health stuff, some depression, or maybe there's, you know, a vitamin deficiency or something like that. Whereas to be honest, it was one of my first thoughts that I wonder if this is some kind of early onset dementia. We had conversations like that for a while, I think. And then when we tried to bring it up to my mom, that was
what happened, Jim?
Really
I'm seeing
hard.
You just, you did a look here. What was that like bringing it up?
It was one of the saddest encounters I ever had with her. When I broached that term with her. Actually, I don't think I even mentioned Alzheimer's. I simply said to her, we should go to a doctor and have them examine you about your memory because you seem to be having some difficulty with memory. And that instantly became, in her terminology, you are accusing me of being senile. And that was one of the worst spats we've ever had in 40-odd years of marriage. And as you said, yes, we've been married for 44 years. If you ask my wife in better days, her answer always would be far too long. But I was not able at that time to get her to go to a neurologist at that time. We did some other counselors. And she fired half a dozen counselors because they couldn't do anything for her. They knew they couldn't do anything for her because it wasn't a matter of counseling. So we didn't get an official diagnosis of Alzheimer's for quite some years, although by the time we got it officially, both Charlene and I knew.
It was obvious.
The ship had truly sailed.
And I think the thing that was really hard, and I imagine is hard for most anyone with this disease, is I think at that stage when the disease was really just starting to emerge and impact her, I mean, a core part of my mom's identity was her intellect. She's just such an intelligent person, as my dad said, a scientist, and just she was funny, but kind of in a sarcastic, like, you know, super clever kind of way. That's just who she is. I think to her, the idea of losing some of that is just terrifying, truly terrifying.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guests are Jim Manji and his daughter, Charlene, sharing their Alzheimer's journey with their wife and mother, Kathleen.
My wife can be simultaneously in her mind an 8-year-old child, and in the very next sentence, the grandmother of the 9-month-old infant.
We'll be back after a short break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Welcome back. Continuing now with my conversation with Jim Manji and his daughter, Charlene, a special edition of our Minding Michigan series where we explore mental health issues in our state. Jim's wife and Charlene's mother, Kathleen, began showing signs of dementia when she was only in her mid-50s, early onset Alzheimer's. Jim was her primary caregiver for 9 years until very recently when he came to the difficult realization she needed to be in a memory care unit. She's there now. And Jim's condo is just about 1,000 feet away within the same retirement community, so he is there with her every day.
Especially the last 6 years or so have been the most terrible years of my life, and at the same time, the most meaningful.
You used the term in talking with our producer, Allie. I think you called it an awful act of love. It's very, very
yes.
Telling choice of words.
Yes, because as you said at the outset, there was something about for better or for worse. And my wife and I have had at least our fair share of better. And now it's time for the other. And I did take care of her 24/7 for all those years. Now, I did that personally alone. But I had a lot of support, not just from Charlene, but also from other people, especially from things like the Alzheimer's mm-hmm. Association. Absolutely invaluable in terms of the resources that they make available. They have a 24/7 volunteer hotline. They have a virtual library. The Alzheimer's Association also has, and this I found very valuable, essentially an online support group, and people from all over the country participate in it. And I have gotten some very, very good advice. For example,
yes,
I went out to the message board and I said, look, I'm having trouble because my wife keeps asking for her mommy. And her mother has passed away 25 years ago. And I keep telling her that, but it's not sticking, and she keeps asking. And the people on the message board, several people, very, very nicely told me I was doing it all wrong. They told me in nice terms, you jerk, you're telling the truth.
Don't do that.
You
right?
Don't do that. And I would like to tell you that in 44 years, I have never lied to my wife. Well, hardly ever.
Yeah.
But I was taught, you have to lovingly lie And it is true that her mother passed away. But when my wife was asking, she was asking from her 8-year-old persona. In her mind, she's 8 years old. So her mommy ought to be in the next room.
And that got you through that moment. Mm-hmm. You learned something fascinating about mirrors.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. Later on, as the disease progressed, Kathleen encountered a pattern that is not universal, but many Alzheimer's victims get confused by reflections. They no longer understand the concept of reflection. I heard her one day in the bathroom yelling, "Go away." She was yelling at that old lady. And after that, she wouldn't go into that bathroom because there was an old lady there. So I had to cover up or take down every mirror in the house. I even had to cover some of our large artwork where the glass would reflect. Charlene had to do the same thing with the mirrors in her house when Mom would come over for a visit. Alzheimer's is not just about forgetting, although that is one of the things that you noticed earlier. It's also about time. Time is different. My wife can be simultaneously in her mind an 8-year-old child, and in the very next sentence, the grandmother of the 9-month-old infant. And that causes her no problem, no cognitive dissonance.
But for you who love her, and I'm thinking, you know, as a daughter, Charlene, we assume we're going to have some certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Is there a sense of anger at who or what? Or feeling cheated?
Yeah, I'd say cheated, I guess. I don't know if I feel angry. I went to therapy for a little while when things with my mom started to become really clear what was going on to me. And I think part of it is, to be honest, when I was younger, when I was a teenager, my mom and I didn't have a great relationship. Like many
mothers
teenagers
and
moms, we,
headbutting time.
We headbutt a lot. And I think we're both fairly stubborn, kind of intense people. And so, we struggled a little bit. But I guess in my mind, I guess I kind of always pictured at some point we'd have like a different kind of adult relationship. Maybe we'd talk through stuff in the past, or maybe we wouldn't, but
it would shift gears.
Yeah, I just pictured, talking about books or talking about marriage or talking about, raising kids or motherhood. And I think when I realized that relationship was not going to happen, that was painful. And I think, there's been some of those key life moments, like my wedding or the birth of my baby, where, my mom was there.
But not there.
But not there. And that's been hard.
That's almost...
especially now as a new mom, there's definitely been moments when I have wished I could really talk to my mom about, what was it like with me, or what do you think I should do? And, she just can't give me that. It's not her fault.
How long since she's known who you are?
I gotta say, I think years. It comes in and out. She has a sister. She had a sister, younger sister, who was a good deal younger than her. And she had kind of a maternal relationship with that sister, Joan. So I think I have been Joan for quite a while. I think actually my baby has been her nephew sometimes. So there's been moments when she's kind of had almost a maternal relationship with me, but I don't think that she realizes I'm her daughter. I think sometimes she thinks I'm her younger sister.
And Jim, does she know you are her husband, or is that slipped away?
Not clearly. She knows that she knows me. Mm-hmm. And at the memory center now, she's happy to see me. But it's not clear to me that she has a clear understanding of quite who I am.
And you say memory center because I know you recently made the decision that it was time. How did you know it was time to move her out and into the memory center?
Through the mediation of the Alzheimer's Association, I got a lot of input. And the universal advice was there is no one moment, but you will know the time.
How did you know?
Among other things, I had a trip to the emergency room myself. I thought it might have been a small stroke or something like that for me.
Not a stress.
Stress had something to do with it, yes, indeed. And there's my wife, you know, there in the house, and she's basically helpless to help me. And I'm thinking, you know, if something happens to me, the ambulance who took me, the local ambulance, Huron Valley, they're terrific. They were very respectful to my wife in recognizing that they needed to take care of her, too. So that worked out okay, but that was one signal to tell me that I needed to get professional help for my wife. And we arranged it, and I have to admit that that I did use some considerable trickery. She was getting reluctant to leave the house, which was another trigger. She was getting agoraphobic, and that's bad to have them be completely isolated and away from any other social contact except for me.
And bad for you to be...
Well, that too.
Also completely isolated.
Certainly. So, yeah. So what I did with some planning with the memory center is that morning I switched off the furnace and let the house cool down a little bit and went into the bedroom and I said, "Sweetheart, I got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is the furnace is broken and it's going to take a couple of days to fix it and it's going to be very cold. But the good news is, sweetheart, I've got a place arranged for us to stay that'll keep us nice and warm." Oh, okay. So I got her dressed, got her up, and we walked the 1,000 feet down to the memory center. And they were expecting us, and they knew the fable I had told her. So they said, "Oh, we're sorry to hear about your furnace, but we'll keep you nice and warm here." And they took her and telling her, "Sweetheart, I have to go back to the house and work with the furnace guys," and turning around and leaving the memory center, knowing that my wife, in all likelihood, will never leave that place, has got to be up there. Well, let me tell you it this way. 50 years ago, when I was in the Army, I thought I had done the most difficult thing I'd ever have to do. I was the next of kin notification officer. I had to knock on doors and say, "Mrs. Jones, your son has been killed in Vietnam." The only thing I knew that was more difficult than doing that the first time was doing it the second time the same day. So for a long time, I thought that was the most difficult thing I would ever have to do. I was wrong.
You'd hit the depths and you were wrong.
I was wrong.
It was walking that 1,000 feet. And yet you can be with her and you can see her, but it was like a finality, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And Charlene knows right from there, I drove up to her house. Mm-hmm. And we went through several boxes of Kleenex that afternoon. And when I came home and walked in the house, sure enough, it was cold because I forgot to turn the furnace back on. And my wife, in better days, would have said, "It serves you right, stud muffins."
What do you want to come out of your sharing this journey with Alzheimer's, with your wife and with your mother? What do you hope will come from this? Charlene, I'll let you start.
It's a really hard disease. It takes people away, but they're still there. And that's hard to watch. It's really hard to watch your loved one fade away. I think I want people to know that although right now, there is not a lot you can do for your loved one other than try and make them comfortable, you know, and try and be with them and go with them with whatever they're thinking. I want people to know that even though, you know, there's no cure for this disease, the treatments are limited, there is help out there. there are other people going through the same thing. The number grows every day, every minute. And there are ways that you can find support. I've also gotten involved in the Alzheimer's Association. I do some advocacy and fundraising through a young professional group here in town. And that, to me, has been really healing, to feel that even though I can't do a lot to help my mom directly, I can maybe help the next generation dealing with this disease. So I would just encourage people to not feel like you're alone, to not feel, I think people feel almost a sense of shame or embarrassment or something around this disease. And it's nothing to be ashamed or embarrassed of. It's nothing anyone can do about. We don't know what causes it. And all we can do is try and support each other and try and help our loved ones the best we can.
Jim, what do you want to say?
I agree completely with my daughter, which is always a good thing for a dad to do. it's a disease. It's not a disgrace. We don't yet understand the disease, and we hope that people like the Alzheimer's Association are, we know that they're working towards the day when there finally is an Alzheimer's survivor, because so far, there has never been one. I sincerely hope that Charlene's generation will see the first Alzheimer's survivor. But until then, we need to recognize it as a disease. We need to treat it with as much compassion as possible. And we need to reach out to our neighbors who are dealing with it. Even in the time that I've been here in Michigan, I have been touched by the kindness of strangers. One quick anecdote. We went to a play at intermission. Someone had noticed that I was shepherding my wife around, and a lady whom I'd never met before came up on my far side and whispered in my ear, "Would you like me to help your wife in the restroom?" You know, and that kind of kindness of strangers just brings tears to my eyes. And I want to do as much as I can to encourage other people to demonstrate that kindness of strangers to people who are dealing in various stages with this terrible disease until such time as we don't have to deal with it anymore.
That was Jim and Charlene Manji sharing their Alzheimer's journey. You can listen to our entire conversation by going to michiganradio.org. Jim and Charlene certainly have a lot of company in caring for someone they love who has Alzheimer's. More than 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, and some 200,000 have that early onset disease like Kathleen. Tomorrow, I'll talk with Jennifer Howard, the Michigan Great Lakes chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, about the ways they can help families cope with a diagnosis that offers few, if any, options.
They're dealing with a fatal disease diagnosis and one that really has no effective treatment. So, you know, if you get any other kind of diagnosis, let's say you get a cancer diagnosis, there's a treatment plan and a support system that's put in place for you. When you get an Alzheimer's diagnosis, what normally happens is they say, well, you know, you have Alzheimer's disease, set an appointment for 6 months from now or a year from now, and we'll check back and see how you're doing. And that's the end of the conversation.
That will be tomorrow, right here on Stateside.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Skahn. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.